From the 1960s to the 1990s, one of the most feared gangsters in Australia was a man named Stan Smith. Stan Smith was never quite the Mr. Big of Australian crime, but he was the Mr. Dangerous. He was the gunman behind some of that era's most notorious gangland murders. And Stan Smith often acted as the enforcer for major figures like Lenny McPherson and George Freeman. Stan Smith hated heroin, for reasons that'll become clear down the track, but he was a key figure in the marijuana trade. And in that role, he met an extremely odd cast of characters, including four-star Filipino generals, hippies on the Sunshine Coast, and a disgraced English lord. And then, in the last years of his life, Stan Smith underwent a radical transformation. Jack the Insider is back on Conversations today with the unlikely story of Stan the Man Smith. Jack is a true crime writer and a blogger for the Australian's website, where he writes about politics, history and sport. His real name is Peter Hoisted, but I always call him Jack. Welcome back, Jack.
G'day, Richard.
Jack, for you, the story of Stan Smith starts, in a funny sort of way, on Christmas Eve 1965, when you were just a little kid. What do you remember of that time, Jack?
Rather convoluted story, but yes, I was a mere stripling at 3.5 years of age, Richard, and I was sitting on the steps of my back veranda, overhearing my mother and father discuss the escape from Pentridge Prison of Ronald Ryan and Peter Walker. And my memory of it is that Melbourne was in a state of panic, and people were being discouraged from going out in the streets, doing their Christmas shopping. People were being told to be very, very wary of these two men who were armed and dangerous. They'd fled Pentridge, Ryan and Walker. An armed robbery had occurred in the Melbourne suburb of Ormond that Ryan and Walker committed, and that was on the 28th of December. And there was a suggestion there was a two-man crime wave. And my thoughts, of course, as a 3.5-year-old boy, were, what's this going to do to Christmas? I mean, this is going to be the end of Christmas as I know it. This is probably my first crack at a Christmas, and it's going to be ruined by these two men.
Ronald Ryan was going to have Christmas cancelled for you.
Yeah.
Now he of course would go on to become the last man in Australia ever to be hanged for a crime. So he was on the lam at this time. What was his plan at the time, Jack?
Ryan and Walker were holed up in a flat in Elwood. And the day they committed the armed robbery, there was a party there. It was actually Christmas Eve. And there was a man who went along to that party, a man with no criminal background, by the name of Arthur Henderson, who identified them both. And Walker took Henderson with him on the basis that they were going to find a sly grog place that Walker knew of. And Henderson was shot in the head at close range.
What, for having recognised them?
Yes, that's right, in a public convenience. So this, of course, added to the sense of panic, of course. But it also made things incredibly hot for those two men, not that they weren't tropical anyway. And Ryan held on to this sort of almost childlike belief that he could flee the country, make his way to Brazil, and hole himself up there. And as we learnt with Ronnie Biggs, Australia, and indeed England at the time, had no extradition treaty with Brazil. And that was Ryan's plan.
So how was he going to do that, though?
Ryan and Walker had both spent some time in Sydney. My understanding is that Peter Walker made the contact with Len McPherson, and Len McPherson was known then as the Mr. Big of the Sydney crime scene. And if anyone could do this for them, that is, obtain false passports, flight tickets out, etc., it would be Len McPherson, they figured. So they made contact with McPherson, and Ryan and Walker sped up the Hume Highway, I think on New Year's Eve 1965, made their way to Sydney. They had planned to meet Len McPherson, exchange their dough for the false passports and the airline tickets at the Concord Private Hospital in Sydney's West.
And what happened when they got there?
Well, they didn't know. They were basically dealing with this sort of viper's nest of arrangements between Sydney crime figures and corrupt police. Len McPherson was a famous informant in the criminal parlance, a fizz gig. So rather than obtain these false passports and the airline tickets, Len just got straight onto the phone to the dynamic detective Ray Machine Gun Kelly.
What kind of a man was Ray Machine Gun Kelly, Jack?
Oh, Ray Kelly was an incredibly corrupt police officer who'd overlooked murders. He obtained corrupt funds from armed robberies, went and stood over the perpetrators there. He was a notoriously corrupt figure, and this only became known after his career ended. But at the time, he was regarded almost as a hero.
So Lenny McPherson gave the information about Ronald Ryan and Walker to Ray Machine Gun Kelly. So what happened to Ryan and Walker once they got to Concord Hospital?
Rather than meeting Lenny, they faced Ray Kelly and 50 armed police officers, and they were arrested without incident. They didn't really know what hit them. They were both extradited to Victoria. Ryan was convicted of the murder of the prison guard Hodson and hanged in February 1967. And Walker was given a life sentence for the murder of Henderson.
And what about Ray Machine Gun Kelly? What kind of praise did he earn for having nabbed the notorious Ryan and Walker?
If you read the media reports at the time, I mean, he had become almost this sort of comic superhero. Len McPherson basically made him a legend. And he was interviewed by this media throng that was hanging on his every word. And Kelly said, "I've been on many hunts in my life, but the best hunt is a man hunt." As if he'd sort of followed the spoor of Ryan and Walker all the way up the Hume Highway. But all, of course, he'd done was taken a call from Len McPherson and popped down to the Concord Private Hospital with plenty of wallopers behind him. So clearly, Kelly was very, very grateful to Len McPherson for this.
Yes, indeed. So Ray Kelly's a hero in the eyes of the people of Sydney and New South Wales and the people of Australia by and large. What was the quid pro quo with Len McPherson? What did Lenny McPherson get out of this?
Well, he got the green light. And the green light meant that Len McPherson and his associates could do whatever they liked in New South Wales, including murder. The only rule was do not shoot at a police officer.
That was it?
So that was it. You can do whatever you like. You can pull armed robberies. You can commit murders. You can do whatever you like, as long as you don't embarrass us and as long as you don't raise your weapon at a New South Wales police officer.
And were there corrupt payments to police as part of the green light, or was it just open slather there?
Look, there would have been payments all the way along. Particularly if there was an armed robbery, the police would take sort of 30 or 40% of that in the case of McPherson, in the case of McPherson's gang, if you like. But McPherson was involved in building construction extortion rackets. He was involved in prostitution rackets, standovers of brothels in the Sydney area. He was involved to a lesser degree in the running of casinos, certainly funding them. So, yes, there would be money going back and forth between his hands and those of Kelly and other police officers.
So this incident, the capture and hanging of Ronald Ryan, was really, ultimately, the making of Lenny McPherson.
Yeah.
And where did Stan Smith fit in to that arrangement, Jack?
Well, Smith was Len McPherson's strong man. He was a lot younger, he was a lot fitter, and he had a great propensity for violence. By my count, about 25 shooting incidents and 14 murders, and these are all, for the most part, contract killings, a person that was causing them grief, a person who was imposing themselves on their rackets, a person who just got in the way. Stan Smith would be called upon to dispose of that person.
What part of Sydney was Stan Smith born into, Jack?
He's born in Balmain, born in Depression-era Balmain in 1937. He shared that with Lenny. Lenny was also a Balmain boy. And it's a very, I mean, it's a beautiful and very genteel suburb now, but it was a really rough and tumble suburb in those days. There was a lot of material going in and out of the docks at Balmain. And so McPherson and Smith were involved in all sorts of hijacking rackets and making things disappear. That was their sort of home base.
So how did he fall foul of the law as a kid, Jack?
Well, he was involved in really minor things, like a great many of these gangland figures. You see that they have a really sort of an accelerated childhood development, so they might be involved in things like pinching things of no great value, but they get grabbed by the police, and after about their second conviction, they're sent off to a boys' home.
Last time you were here, you were talking about how a whole generation of major Sydney crime figures were all sent to a man, to one of these boys' homes, as kids or as teenagers, and came out as brutalised human beings.
Yeah.
This was the case with Stan Smith too, Jack?
It was, and this is something that he shared with McPherson, although McPherson was 16 years his senior, and it's probably the basis of their friendship in many ways. They both got to these reform schools as relatively young children. So Stan gets to the Gosford Boys' Home at 14 years of age, and that's very young. And if you understand the borstal system in Great Britain, it relied essentially on a small number of guards using senior boys who were almost men, 17, 18 years of age, or 16, 17 years of age, who would actually mete out the discipline. So if you arrive there and you're 14, it's a really horrible place to be. And I know for a fact that Len McPherson and Stan Smith were both sexually and physically abused on a routine basis.
So what was he like when he got out?
Well, he did a stretch at Gosford Boys' Home. He did another one at Tamworth. And so by the time he gets out at 17, he is a really, really violent man. And very, very angry. Angry at society, angry at anyone who gets in his way. Strangely, at this time, well, when he turns 18, he marries his wife. And they had this sort of incredible, sort of almost textbook romance that lasted until Stan died many, many years later. They were married for 54 years. So there was this soft side to him. But at the same time, Smith is starting now as a young adult to work around the prostitution business in Sydney in the 50s. He was running standover rackets there that were utterly brutal towards the working girls. There are stories of him grabbing one woman and hanging her from the fourth floor window by her ankles. You could say it was all part of extortion rackets, and when you're running extortion rackets, you've got to be more violent than everybody else, otherwise you won't be feared. But there was something really disturbing about his violence. It was often just spontaneous and just lashing out. So it wasn't in that sort of controlled way that an extortion racket would run. There was stories that if you were a prostitute and you sat next to Stan Smith in a club and you did not provide sexual favours, then you would be savagely beaten. So that's not just extortion. This is a real lashing out, a really nasty, violent human being, really acting out on some of the violence that was perpetrated on him when he was a teenager. It's not an excuse, but it is at least an explanation.
How did they then rise to the top of the Sydney crime scene, Jack?
Well, by the early 60s, McPherson's got a name for himself. And throughout the next decade, there are a series of murders of other crime figures. There were car bombings, there were shootings, and McPherson and Smith were at the heart of this. They emerged almost anonymously at the start of the 1960s, and by the end of it, by a series of strategic murders, if you like, of their enemies and their competitors, they had reached the top.
This was because of the green light, is it?
The green light's significant. The green light, which was pretty much handed to them in 1966, allowed them just to attack anybody, allowed them to commit murders, make people disappear and so forth. And there was never, you know, they did it with impunity. There were never any consequences.
What kind of arrangement did they come to with George Freeman? He's the other major Sydney crime figure of the time.
Yeah, George was a professional shoplifter, and Lenny said in his rather gruff way that he always said you're always getting pinched for stealing. George, you're really good with numbers and you're really good with the horses. Why don't you get involved in that? And so these three men had sort of parceled up their various criminal activities, and George Freeman was sort of handed this casino and SP bookmaking caper, all under the aegis of Smith and McPherson. The three of them became known as the team. I mean, there were other members, but those three were the most significant.
So they had a kind of an understanding not to tread on each other's toes.
Yeah, it's often said that Lenny's Mr. Big, but that's not quite right. They were as big as each other, and they ran their own capers. It was just that if there are any competitors, any rivals, broke into George Freeman's business, SP bookmaking, or McPherson's extortion rackets and construction sites or prostitution business, or Stan's standing over brothels and clubs and sly groggers, then you would meet all three of them and their small army of soldiers, foot soldiers. If you crossed one, you crossed them all.
Did this form a kind of a golden age for Sydney gangsters?
Well, it predated the narcotics business. There were lucrative businesses in prostitution, sly grogging, casinos and SP bookmaking. I think from memory, the New South Wales TAB didn't start till the late 1950s. So if people wanted to have a bet and they weren't at a race course, they'd go to a pub and there'd be a bloke sitting at the end of the bar there with half a dozen form guides on the bar, and he would be the guy you'd go and place a bet with. And this is very common, and it happened really in every pub you can think of in Australia. Freeman had a sort of umbrella group of about 300 or 400 SP bookmakers, and they all went to him because they knew if people didn't pay, if people were betting on credit and they ended up owing the bookmaker a lot of money, then George Freeman would be able to get the money for them by fair means or foul.
As we said, Stan Smith was involved in several notorious gangland shootings, and one of the most notorious ones was the murder of a man called Robert Pretty Boy Walker in Randwick in 1963. What was the background to that shooting, Jack?
Walker was a pimp himself, and so there was this inevitable clash. This is Lenny and Stan's core business, and Walker was breaking in on it, so that couldn't stand. So Smith went to see Walker, who lived in the eastern suburbs. They clearly fell out and there was a shooting, and Stan Smith was shot and wounded by Walker. Not seriously, but he was hospitalised for a couple of days.
There was an axe to grind there against Walker with cutting in on Lenny's business and shooting Stan.
He had to be made an example of. And it had to be done ruthlessly and swiftly. I mean, Walker had gone into hiding. He was holed up in a motel in Randwick, and McPherson and Smith were kicking over everything, trying to find out where he was. And at the same time, Lenny's getting prepared to marry for the second time. And on the day of Len McPherson's second wedding, he was married in Balmain, they got word, Smith and McPherson got word of where Walker was.
On the day of the wedding?
On the day of the wedding. So they have the ceremony, and then Smith and McPherson slip away. They go, I believe, to Kingsford, where they change clothes, and then went on to this motel in Randwick, and they got there and Walker wasn't there. Walker had made his way, he was on his way to a pub, and he was walking down pretty much outside the Randwick racecourse there. And Smith and McPherson pulled up. Smith was driving. McPherson had a submachine gun and hit him about 40 or 50 times, and they drove off, and they were back in time for the speeches. So basically, they've committed a murder between Lenny being married and the ceremony thereafter.
How long were they gone for from the wedding?
Well, probably about 2 hours. But at the same time, if you think about this, I mean, it's the perfect alibi. I mean, anyone asked is going to say, well, we saw him at the ceremony, and we saw him at the reception, and you know, they were there all the time. And if they'd slipped away, perhaps it was presumed they'd gone and have some photos taken or whatever. It was a perfect alibi.
I'm also conscious by the fact that someone shot down with 40 bullets out of a machine gun out the front of Randwick Racecourse, Jack. It puts a new light on things when the people say, oh, the world's gone mad today. The world is much more violent now than the good old days back then. I don't know if it's been a while since someone's been gunned down with 40 bullets in front of Randwick Racecourse, Jack.
Yeah, look, and it must be said, and certainly through Smith and McPherson's so-called team, these things were almost commonplace in Sydney. You'd have one every year or so at least, yeah.
Part of his role, it seems, was Stan Smith's role, was to deal with some of the crazier figures that would pop up around the place. Characters like Stuart John Regan. Tell me about him, Jack.
Well, Stuart John Regan was a psychopath who'd also sort of established himself as a pimp and brothel owner, or a standover man of brothels and so forth, an incredibly violent man.
His nickname was the Magician. Why was that?
Yeah, because he used to make people disappear, and he's known for doing exactly that with what was known as the Toe Cutter Gang in Sydney, a bunch of extortionists who'd bail up armed robbers after they'd committed armed robberies, and through corrupt police, the notoriously corrupt police officer Fred Cray, these toe cutter gangs would go bail up these robbers, detain at least one of them. And they were known as the toe cutter gang because, you know, they'd get the bolt cutters out and they'd snip little toes off and so forth. But as one gangster told me, he said, I knew that once they took off the toe, they weren't just going to bandage you up and let you walk away. And once they started, that was it. You were gone. So this group was hated by New South Wales criminal figures.
Why were they hated? Because they were attacking other criminals.
Yeah, they were attacking other criminals and they were working for the police. And so basically, they, you know, Cray would end up with all the money and the toe cutter gang, they would receive the small amount of money and the police would receive the rest of it.
So this steward, John Regan, who is one of the members of this toe cutter gang, how did he come a cropper with Stan Smith, Jack?
Well, Regan, as I said, is a dreadful human being. He had been accused of a child murder, which he almost certainly did, and the police investigated it. It was actually, he was holed up with a prostitute at the time, and it was her son, a little boy, I think about 4 years of age. And while she was out working, she left her son with Stuart John Regan, which is a pretty silly thing to do. The boy disappeared. The body was never found. But everyone knew that Regan had committed this murder. The police had not enough evidence to charge him. So it was determined. I mean, this is the way the team worked. There was a sort of moral structure to this. They also understood that Regan was a violent man who, if they didn't deal with, would come after them. So there's a sort of sense of self-protection about this too. But they also sort of assumed this moral, oh, the police can't do anything about this, you know, we'll do something about this. So what they did very cleverly was invite Stuart Regan, invite the magician to join them, to join their gang. He was invited to go to a hotel in Marrickville where a criminal by the name of Frederick Paddles Anderson was present with Len McPherson, and he was told he was just being given entry to the team.
Oh, like he's being, right, I was like, we've heard all about you, was it?
Yeah.
You're a terrific bloke and all
yeah.
that.
Yeah, look, you know, we like what you do and we'd like you to come and join us and there's much we can do. Great business synergy. And Regan was then invited to go take a very short walk where George Freeman was waiting for him, and George Freeman was going to show him one of the clubs that was nearby and how their operations worked at that particular place. And he walked up the road where George Freeman was waiting for him, and they all were pally, shaking hands and slapping backs and so forth, and Stan Smith emerged from a shop front and shot Stuart John Regan 4 times, shot him dead, then handed the gun to Freeman, and Freeman shot him 4 times as well.
Why did they both shoot him?
Well, one would never be able to give evidence against the other if the matter had ever come to court. So they were both complicit in the murder. But this is the important thing. Smith was the man who fired the first shot. This very, very dangerous psychopath was there and had to be dealt with, and Smith was the go-to man every time.
What kind of a reputation were these killings giving Stan Smith on the streets of Sydney?
Well, the story goes that when the news came to Long Bay Prison that Stuart John Regan was dead, the entire prison erupted into cheers. I mean, he was a despised human being. So this adds to the reputation of the team, of Stan Smith, of Len McPherson, of George Freeman. This adds to their reputation. It adds to their kudos in the criminal community, that they could do things that other people couldn't.
What kind of drug trafficking did Stan Smith get into?
Well, he was very cunning, and he could actually see in this period, late 60s, early 70s, he could see that there was money to be made in the narcotics business. Now, he always rationalised it by saying, well, I'm only moving marijuana. That was the way he rationalised it. But he realised that there was money to be made there. Now, the two other senior members of the team, Freeman and McPherson, they didn't really want a bar of this.
Why not?
Well, it would mean that a lot of their protection would not be available to them in the courts and with the police as well.
So like a lot of official figures that would be happy to turn a blind eye to prostitution or gambling would actually be deeply offended by drugs.
And we're talking about, you know, judges and magistrates and so forth who are on the payroll. They would not be inclined to be so kind if Freeman or McPherson were brought before them on a marijuana trafficking blue.
So did he mainly stick to marijuana, or did he entirely stay away from heroin and dangerous drugs?
There's a story that he was involved in a cocaine shipment, but it's disputed. So as far as we know, it was marijuana only. Organising plantations in Queensland and the Sunshine Coast hinterland, but obviously marijuana is a crop and it's seasonal, and so when that crop had been harvested and sold, then Stan would start importing hashish from Pakistan and marijuana from other places like the Philippines.
How did the dope network work as such, Jack, then? He'd import this stuff from Pakistan and from the Philippines. He'd have to get it through customs somehow or dropped off at a remote coastline somewhere. What do you know about that?
Basically dropped off at a remote coastline, and often in northern New South Wales, and boats were used, etc. The marijuana would be driven down in a van by Smith. We know this because I've seen some surveillance photos, and he arrived in Sydney, and money would be exchanged. I mean, basically vans would be exchanged. A van full of marijuana would be exchanged for a van full of cash, although perhaps not quite as full. And that's how they used to organise it. They just exchange vehicles in a car park.
You mentioned there he only ever did one stint in jail for 3 months.
Yes.
What was that for? How was he pinched?
He was pinched at Tullamarine Airport in Melbourne. He was a very sort of odd character. He'd moved from these sort of old Sydney gangsters to associating with these sort of bon vivants and musicians and artists in the eastern suburbs of Sydney.
He became a bohemian, did he?
he could see the value in associating with bohemians, and that they would happily move his drugs around for them, that they would actually become distributors for him. And he got involved in the music management business. He was a tour manager for a number of bands, and this is all through these sort of Wallara connections. So there was a Canadian blues band that came to Australia. I think they're still around in some form or other. They must be very old now. But in 1970, they arrived in Australia, and Smith, I really don't know how this happened, but Smith had assumed the role of tour manager. And when they flew to Melbourne, it was police that bailed up Stan, Victorian police, perhaps not quite as malleable as the New South Wales lot at the time, and they found him with a very small amount of amphetamines and an ounce of hashish. And he was charged, and didn't seem to bother him a lot. He was bailed, and he just went straight back to New South Wales and continued on with what he was doing. It took him another 6 or 7 years for him to be pulled up and ultimately extradited back to Victoria, and he did 3 months in penitentiary and walked out.
As part of this, you know, entree into the world of dope and hash, he met some very, very colourful people, probably none more colourful than a man known as Anthony Moynihan. Tell me a little bit about him, Jack, please.
Well, Anthony Moynihan was the third Baron Moynihan to you, Richard. I mean, he was an English peer and a very colourful character, I think we could say. He actually took his seat in the House of Lords. He actually became the Liberal Party then. He was their whip. He was a con artist extraordinaire that routinely ran around passing bad checks. And as a British peer, he was looking at some serious fraud charges. Well, he was given passage out of the country, go away and we'll wait for all this to sort of blow over. And he went to Australia where another peer owned a large sheep farm, and he was supposed to go out and work there and, you know, sort of work out his bad ways.
Right. How long did he last on the sheep farm?
Hitchhiked to Sydney and set himself up in the King's Cross again. And so this is in 1955, Moynihan arrives in King's Cross. And so people of that era, there was a sort of lively, vibrant club scene, and there were sly groggers and there were prostitutes and brothels and so forth. And into this comes Moynihan. And if you were sort of knocking around in those clubs in those days, you would remember this British peer up on stage playing his bongos or playing the banjo for the entertainment of everyone else. But his first trip to Sydney again ended in disgrace. I mean, this is a common theme in his life. He was briefly reconciled with his first wife, but that didn't pan out. So then he flew back through Pakistan, where he met his second wife, who was a belly dancer. And he spent all this time sort of running around Asia. And there is a rather fabulous story where he was in a club in Tokyo and his second wife, the belly dancer, was performing. And an American journalist sort of berated her dancing style, and Moynihan took exception to this, and they organised a duel, and there was going to be a duel, but I can't imagine it. I have difficulty visualising it, but they had a duel where the two men charged at each other with their naked buttocks. So we have this incredibly, he's probably a sociopath, but he's extraordinarily colourful character. Ultimately, he ends up in the Philippines. His belly dancing wife, he had five wives, I think, in the end. His belly dancer wife discarded for a new model, and that was a Filipino and the daughter of one of Marcos's generals.
Right. So this is how Stan Smith gets connected to the military of the Philippines through this down-at-heels dodgy aristocrat.
Well, Stan was used to having police look the other way. And so when you get to the Philippines and the Marcos regime and you've got an in there with a general, you know they're going to be able to get away with whatever they want to get away with. And so there was a remote island in the Filipino archipelago that was set aside for cultivation of marijuana. Stan's first shipment, and this tells you how successful he'd been before he entered into the drug business and the sort of line of credit that he would have had, but his first shipment was a $12 million shipment that he organised with Moynihan that came from the Philippines. And a boat arrived in the middle of the night in northern New South Wales, and marijuana was loaded into a van and driven down to Sydney, and God only knows how much money Stan and Moynihan made out of it.
Sounds like it made him a very wealthy man. Nonetheless, he was still doing contract killings at the time. Yeah. It has been alleged, no one's been able to prove this, but it has been alleged that it was Stan Smith that shot and killed another notorious hitman by the name of Christopher Dale Flannery, the hitman allegedly responsible for the attempted contract killing of a police officer, Michael Drury. Mm. It was rumoured or alleged that Stan Smith was the man that killed Christopher Dale Flannery, who just disappeared off the streets of Sydney in 1985. What's your understanding of what happened on that day, Jack?
I've explored this with some senior police officers and some very, very senior National Crime Authority people. And look, there are different views, but one that is very, very difficult to walk away from. If you understand Flannery's movements on the 9th of May 1985, he left his apartment, or the apartment where his wife and children were staying. He had been called to a meeting at George Freeman's house in Yowie Bay. Now, his car had been, we believe, tampered with, so he couldn't drive. And there was evidence presented later of a taxi driver who had a very, very good memory, very sound, very reliable witness, who took Flannery as a fare and drove him to Sydney Airport. Now, that was often dismissed because it seemed to imply that Flannery had sort of flown away and was living on an island somewhere, you know, sitting in a banana lounge, and that clearly wasn't true. What I believe took place is that Flannery rented a car at the airport, and he often did, with a false credit card that he had, and that he drove this rental car down to Yowie Bay, where he met with Freeman, turned up at Freeman's house, and Freeman had this huge sort of mansion on the water in Yowie Bay. I believe Gus Gould, the maybe not now, but Gus Gould lived there after George Freeman, and Gus always used to say that he was always very careful mowing the lawns in case a couple of bones popped up. But always be careful in the garden. Gus Gould did buy what had been the Freeman residence, this substantial mansion, and at the upper floor was devoted to George's wife, Georgina. Georgina looked after that part.
I've seen pictures of it. I've seen video of it. It looked like Liberace's second home.
Oh, yeah, velvet flock wallpaper, circular beds, satin sheets, all this sort of stuff. Sort of 70s nightmare. Oh, very tasteful, you know, it would have been very tasteful in those days, but it looks awful now.
Yeah.
And so downstairs was the bar, and that was where Freeman did a lot of his business. And there were a number of cupboards, hidden compartments in that place, and that Freeman and Flannery walked downstairs to the bar area, and Stan Smith emerged and shot Flannery dead with, I believe, I've been told, was an automatic weapon.
you'd have to be very sure you knew what you were doing before you tried to shoot a man like that dead, Jack.
Well, that's precisely why I've come to that conclusion. See, other people maintain that it was Len McPherson. I know for a fact that Len McPherson at that time was terrified. I mean, Flannery was running around. Flannery had to be disposed of, they thought, because he was so reckless and so dangerous, and he could kill any of them in a sort of fit of rage, and everyone was fearful. And in that time, McPherson basically didn't leave the home for 6 months, and he'd be, you know, his home in Gladesville, and he'd sort of peer out through the Venetian blinds at every car that came past and jot down the registration number and ring the police and find out who it was. I mean, he was, you know, on the verge of paranoia. So I find it very difficult to see how it would have been McPherson who came out from that secret area, all guns blazing. And it was, in my view, far more likely to be Stan Smith, who'd done this many times before.
How good was Stan Smith at thwarting police surveillance, Jack?
Well, a number of the police I spoke to, I mean, there was a National Crime Authority police officer, I won't name him, but we spoke at length about Stan, and this officer had Stan under surveillance for a long, long time. He was very, very good at just sort of blending in. He wore a baseball cap and sunglasses. I mean, that was his disguise. I mean, it doesn't sound like much of a disguise, but it's almost impossible to prove it's him. The surveillance photos sort of see this sort of shadowy figure arrive and depart, and there's simply not enough there for the police to act any further. I mean, he's very, very clever. He presumed he was being watched. He presumed his phones were off. That means being bugged. And he lived his life accordingly for 40 years.
The 1978 Woodward Royal Commission into the drug trade, he gave evidence at that Royal Commission. Mm. What was he like in the stand?
Oh, he found himself in the company of an army of lawyers and judges and so forth. And he was asked all sorts of very awkward questions about how he had assets to the tune of X and really only income to the tune of Y. And there was a huge discrepancy, and there were cars and properties and so forth. And his response was, oh, you blokes, you know, all you lawyers and that, you know, I left school at 13. I can't compete with you blokes. I don't even know what you blokes are talking about. But really, you know, he pretended to be this ignoramus, but really he was probably the smartest man in the room.
What did he say about drugs and drug use and what he thought about it to the Royal Commission?
He made a tearful, and one must accept as a sort of sincere statement, that he hated drugs, in particular heroin, because his son, Stan Jr., his eldest son, was a heroin addict. And he went into incredible detail about how he had tried to put his son into rehab and get him off heroin. And you could tell it was really something that that disturbed him greatly. So he used that story. I mean, get back to, he's an incredibly manipulative fellow, but he used that story to tell essentially the Woodward Royal Commission that, you know, he was anti-drug.
What happened to his son?
His son died of a heroin overdose, and this is probably the seminal moment in Stan Smith's life.
What did Stan do about that?
Well, he killed the man who sold his boy drugs. You know, it's a sort of stuff of parental fantasy, I suppose, for most of us, if we found ourselves in that position, God forbid. But
how did he do that?
Well, unlike his contract killings, which were swift and brutal, this was planned. He organised to meet this drug dealer. He was a well-known North Shore drug dealer. He organised to meet him in the Wakehurst Parkway on the North Shore in Sydney, and he beat this man severely. He took his time, and then he ran over him in his car 3 or 4 times and left him to die. I mean, you have to understand, this is not a contract killing for him. This is not business. This was personal.
No gun.
No gun. That would have been too quick. Stan really wanted this man to feel a lot of pain.
Funnily enough, Stan Smith, for all that kind of hard-nosed attitude and ability, he did have a kind of hippie side to him too, Jack, didn't he?
Look, he eschewed traditional medicine. I mean, he eschewed medicine. And so he was always on fads and alternative healing methods and so forth. So he didn't attend a doctor, as far as we know, for pretty much all his life, and perhaps until the latter part of it, the very latter part of it. So he was always sort of, you know, on some sort of amino acid kick or burning incense and
right.
So forth in the
house. If he was around today, he'd be getting stuck into the acai berries.
Yeah. Right. Look, he may well be a paleo man. I don't know. I mean, but yeah, it was a series of fad diets. He was an incredibly fit bloke too. I mean, he looked after himself, but yeah, it was all through these sorts of weird alternative methods.
Well, it didn't do him any harm, obviously, by the sound of things.
No.
There were many conversations between him, as he got older, between him and Lenny McPherson that were recorded by police. What's in those conversations, Jack?
Well, there's a very funny one. You asked about counter-surveillance before. You know, they had Stan and Len McPherson's phone off, and they were sitting out a few houses down the road from Stan's place in Whale Beach, up at Whale Beach at the time. And so Stan had ring Len, and Stan was this cautious man. So no names and don't divulge any information. So they used to speak in a kind of code, and they'd known each other for many, many years. So Stan would expect that to be the case. So he'd say, "Now listen, let's meet at that place, you know, that place where we had the duck." And Lenny would go, "Oh, you mean the Royal Standard?" And the phone would go down. Well, after a stream of abuse from Stan, the phone would go down. And then half an hour later, he'd ring him up and said, "Now, listen, you can't sort of give anything away here, you know, so we can't meet at that place of the duck." And he said, "So let's meet at that place. You know that place that got burnt down over the road? We'll meet at that place." And Lenny would go, "Oh, good on you, Stan. We'll meet." And, you know, he just named him. And so yes, you know, and he did just a stream of abuse. And the phone would go down again. The police officer were telling me this. They're just falling all about the place and just laughing. But it's really illustrative of the sort of man Stan Smith was. So careful, so cautious. And Len, who was a pretty cunning character himself, was a bit of a bumbler by comparison.
Did you ever see him? Did you ever see Stan Smith in person?
Yeah, I did. I was having a beer in the Royal Oak Hotel in Double Bay with a group of friends, and it was a bit of a scallywags pub, and it always has, it's had a sort of long history. I'm not sure that that's the case now, but it certainly had this long history of colourful characters. The heroin dealer and murderer Ned Smith used to go down there on a Monday night and talk to the SPs and organise anyone who had to collect money off, for example. So it had this sort of colourful background. We were just having a beer, and one fellow was with just sort of elbowed me in the chest and said, "That's Stan Smith," in this sort of whispered tone, you know. And I looked around, and it took me a little while to clock him, but he was wearing his baseball cap. He was, I guess you would call it, smartly dressed, casually but smartly dressed. And he wandered in through the pub, and it was really funny, because what I remember about it was that it was almost like a principal walking into a classroom, and everyone there, a few scallywags among them, would all be sort of sitting up straight on their best behaviour. Now, Stan would have been in his mid-60s then, but even then, his reputation preceded him to the point where people sort of understood he was there before he actually arrived.
And did he have any kind of like dark charisma about him, or was he nondescript?
Yeah, sort of unremarkable. This is a guy who has spent his life trying to be unremarkable.
Right, to look invisible, right.
Yeah, yeah. Almost invisible, yeah.
That's how he's able to step out of a cupboard and shoot people down without being particularly seen and noticed.
Mm.
In the last decade or so of his life, Jack, Stan Smith changed. He underwent a conversion of a kind. Mm. What do you know about that?
Well, he found God. He fell into a Pentecostal group. I've seen the tape of his baptism. He was baptized a Christian. From all reports, it was a very sincere conversion.
My God, at that point in his life.
Well, not to the point where he'd walked down to the local police station and confessed to all those murders that he did, Richard. Not quite to that point, but it wasn't really a prison type conversion where someone, it might be said, has converted in order to receive a lighter sentence. So it was at least that genuine, and it was genuine to a point where he was involved in volunteer work. He was out helping feeding the homeless. He'd do letterbox drops for the church. there are some very, very funny stories about all of this because he's still a crime figure. I mean, some people say he'd retired, but I don't think that's true.
Oh, so he's still running this marijuana network very likely then, Jack, is he?
Well, so as far as we know, he's still accumulating money. So, yes, he's still in the crime business. And, of course, he was a person of such considerable reputation in the criminal world that aspiring up-and-coming crooks, gangsters, would go and see him at his home and seek his approval for their criminal enterprises. And Stan would sort of get laying on the hands sort of thing, you know. He'd have them on their knees, all three of them, and praying to Jesus for the success of their criminal enterprise.
For the success of their criminal enterprise?
Yes. Forgiveness.
No.
This is Stan. Wow. This is Stan saying, you know, let's all get on our knees, fellas, and let's pray to Jesus over this, you know.
It sounds to me, Jack, like the only way you can kind of make something seem like that work is that Stan, it sounds like he figured all his life he was doing work that was entirely moral.
There is certainly some rubbery morality there.
Yeah.
Some people maintain that he walked away from crime, but I'm not convinced of that.
He died in 2010. How much money did he leave behind him?
I've spoken to a lot of people about this because he was an incredibly successful criminal, if you want to use that term, successful. But it also accumulated an enormous amount of money, and most of it through marijuana trafficking, although he'd been very clever about his investments too. So he'd invested in property and so forth. So when he died, he left this world with about $25 million. Not bad for a boy from Depression era Balmain.
What happened to that money?
I believe a good deal of it ended up at the church.
That's extraordinary, Jack.
Well, he had sinned quite considerably,
right,
and very often, Richard, and perhaps that was his penance.
You see him as a transitional figure in the history of Sydney or Australian crime. How so? Explain that a bit, please.
He traversed the old, traditional, organised crime enterprises into this new drug world, and very few were able to do this. His reputation in the Sydney crime scene was second to none. Rather than other sort of criminals that are well known who demand the spotlight, and I suppose if we look at Melbourne's Carl Williams, that might be a very good example. They demand the spotlight. They demand to be spoken about. Stan Smith thought the best way he would go about things was to go through his life making as little fuss as possible. And he was very effective at it. This is a guy who murdered at least a dozen people. And in cold blood, he was a rather horrendous human being. But he was, in my view, the most ruthless contract killer this country's ever seen. And we talked about Flannery, and there are others that we could mention, but I don't think any of them hold a candle to Stan the Man Smith.
Great to speak with you, and fantastic to get this story, Jack. I'd love to invite you back down the track to tell the story of Lord Moynihan as well.
Oh yes, love to.
Thank you so much, Jack.
Pleasure, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.